The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
Now, the author Paul Lynch is with us for the Culture Club tonight. His new novel is Beyond the Sea, and we'll chat a little bit about that later on. But before he really got into writing novels, Paul was a journalist with the Sunday Tribune, where I worked with him. He was also chief film critic there. So I think the best place for us to start would be your favourite movie, because you must have seen thousands of movies between work and pleasure.
Absolutely. I did a rough count. When I finished working for the Tribune, and I had reviewed over 1,000 films. So that's 1,000 films just for work and not including pleasure. So at home, I would have a few thousand films on DVD and always tended to watch film more than television when I wasn't reading books. The question I get asked all the time, of course, is, you know, what's your favourite film? And it's always a difficult thing to answer because you're faced
with... There must be loads.
It's just endless, you know, endless. And depending what mood you're in and, you know, you start thinking about a particular country and suddenly you think you get all these directors start flooding your mind. But I have to say, there's one film in particular, and it's so obvious, but it's true. It's Vertigo by Alfred Hitchcock. And I remember very clearly on a June day in Paris about 10 years ago, and I saw a listing for this film. It was on at 1 o'clock in the day, a beautiful summer's day. And I thought, well, I'm going to go see this because, you know, you don't let go an opportunity to see Vertigo in the cinema. And I thought, well, I'm going to be the only sad fool in here on this day. But lo and behold, I arrive up and the place is full. And it's full because people are obsessed with Vertigo. And Vertigo is a film, of course, about obsession.
Let's hear a clip from it. Before we hear the clip, you better explain the movie, because it's a 1958 movie and it's a psychological thriller. How many times have you seen it, do you reckon?
At least 10, probably more. Probably close to 15.
Even though you know what's going to happen.
But see, this is the thing about a film that is as mysterious as Vertigo, that even though you know what's going to happen, there's something about the film's mood that's so unique that no other film has that mood. And it affects you differently every time.
Jimmy Stewart was in it. He was a Hitchcock favourite, wasn't he?
Of course he was. And Jimmy Stewart in this film plays a character called Scotty, who discovers at the opening of the film that he has vertigo, hanging off the ledge of a building, staring down into an alleyway while chasing a thief. And the policeman who tries to rescue him falls over the ledge and dies. And Scotty ends up being retired and, you know, cannot deal with heights. It doesn't help him when he visits his friend's apartment and she's living, you know, stories high, and he falls off the stool. But he ends up getting a phone call from an old school friend who asks him to come and to consider taking on a case as a retired detective, because his wife, as we learn later, played by Kim Novak, is acting very strange and has become obsessed with a woman who died 100 years ago called Carlotta Valdez. And so Jimmy Stewart, Scotty, ends up following this woman around San Francisco. And I suppose it's, you know, it's a San Francisco that doesn't look like San Francisco now. And he ends up quietly becoming obsessed with her.
Well, let's hear this clip, which features both Jimmy Stewart and Kim Novak, in which Novak's character doesn't take kindly to being questioned about her whereabouts prior to falling into San Francisco Bay.
Thank you for the fire.
Where were you before?
When?
This afternoon, I mean.
Wandering about?
I know, but where? Where were you just before?
Downtown, shopping.
Here, you better have some coffee. I think it's still warm.
You're terribly direct in your questions.
Well, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to be rude.
You're not. You're merely direct.
Excuse me now if this question seems a bit silly to you, but the use of music in that is a way that you wouldn't hear in a modern movie, would you? Sort of create
there'd
sort
be
of dramatic
thudding
effect.
Noises and booms and things to keep you on your toes. And the thing about this film is it's a mood piece. It is an atmospheric piece. You know, a lot of people think of that famous scene where she walks in the hotel room, where she walks into the room wearing the outfit. As I should explain the plot, I'll explain the plot in a moment, but she's wearing the outfit that he wants her to be dressed in. And she's now looking like the blonde Hitchcockian woman that he wants her to be. And there's that famous green tinged neon light That is, it's a very famous moment. And the thing about the film is that, you know, Scotty is obsessed with her, but he doesn't realize he has been set up, and that she's actually not the wife of his friend, and she's playing the part of the wife, but she starts falling for him. So he's fallen for a woman who's not real. She's fallen for him. And we're falling for the actress. And so, the film is playing out and asking questions about our own voyeurism as moviegoers, because we fall in love with actresses and actors.
Okay. Is this one to be enjoyed on your TV screen at home, or do you have to see it in the cinema?
No, look, most people now have
big television,
big tellies, and big tellies.
You're thinking of a certain generation, Paul. There's another generation that watch all these things on mobile phones and laptops.
But, you know, the best thing I ever heard said about that, it was Anthony Lane, I think, in The New Yorker, who described that famous scene in Lawrence of Arabia where he's coming along the sand dunes from basically a speck in the distance, and he's finally crossed the desert, and he's getting larger and larger, and he described, imagine watching that on an iPhone.
There was also a famous technical effect, wasn't there, in Vertigo, which was pioneered, which is featured in so many movies since.
Yeah, well, it was the effect of zooming in and pulling the camera back at the same time to create that feeling of vertigo. And that's how they did it. I'm not a technical...
A dolly zoom.
A dolly zoom, yeah. They zoomed in and then withdrew back. Very famous shot.
Before we move off movies, seeing as you have more interest in movies than you have in television, just tell us what are the ones that would stick with you from all of your time watching, as you say, thousands and thousands of movies.
There was a French gangster film that I've watched a lot, nearly every year since I reviewed it. I think it came out in 2007, and it was called A Prophet, and it was by Jacques Audiard, and it was really quite an extraordinary film, and many people, including myself, would lay claim that it is up there with The Godfather as a modern gangster film. It certainly was the best gangster film I had the privilege to review, and it's also one of the best prison films. It's the story of a young man who, you know, a young Algerian French man who is thrown into prison, and he's completely helpless. He knows nobody. He's clearly come through the system and has been abused by the system, and he has absolutely no power. By the end of the film, he emerges from that prison with a phalanx of supporters, like a prophet. He's like a modern day Mohammed, and the people are leaving who've come to collect him as he exits the prison. And so the film is about what happens to him in that prison. How does he reach this level of, mafioso, don position? It's really an extraordinary film.
Of course, the cinema theatres here in Ireland, and indeed much of the television that we watch, is all focused on Hollywood and the movies that come out of there. Is Netflix giving perhaps a more opportunity for Irish people to get the stories that are coming from other parts of the world and the movies, which may actually are no longer been made in Hollywood now that Hollywood has become obsessed with cartoon superheroes and franchises?
Yeah, well, look, I during my time as a critic, I felt like I was watching sort of the end of Hollywood. And what I mean by that is it just seemed that the days when Hollywood made films for grown-ups had come to an end, and we were entering into a period of films for teenagers. Everything was being made essentially for 14-year-old boys, or at least that's how it felt to me at the time. And I kind of got bored of that.
It's gotten worse.
It seems to be the case. And, I can't say that I get to the cinema very much anymore because I have small children now. But what I've noticed with Netflix is they're funding the kind of films that don't get supported by Hollywood. And, of course, Roma was, the famous example last year, which was an incredibly beautiful film. And that got made through Netflix money. And but the pity about that is that was a film to see in the cinema. And I think it got a very limited run in Ireland for a week. And I saw it, and it was quite exquisite. But I know I was talking to people. I was visiting France, and I don't think it got a release there. People didn't know about it, and a lot of people wanted to see it on the big screen.
Okay, well, of course, what's going to happen with The Irishman as well, coming out very soon. It'll get about a week in the cinemas before it'll be available on Netflix. Your favourite TV show at the moment, though, I believe, is on Netflix. You've picked Easy. What's that?
Well, I have a love-hate relationship with Netflix. You know, like a lot of people, you throw it on when you're kind of going, okay, I'm really tired now. It's, I have an hour and a half, 2 hours before I go to bed. What am I going to do with myself? And I had this period of time where I decided that I wasn't going to watch Netflix at all, that I was going to listen to music instead or do something that I felt was more you know, a little bit more creative than just searching through Netflix to find something that I could half like and then go, okay, this is passable. And then I got a message from a friend saying, you really should watch Easy. And so I did. And it's 3 seasons long. It's a it's a 3-part series set in Chicago. And what's interesting about it, because it has a different feeling than most television programs, because it's made by a guy called Joe Swanberg, who made his name as a director of a lot of mumblecore films. Now, mumblecore films was a kind of a movement 15 plus years ago of low budget, improvisational, quiet, really real life like films. And so he brings all these qualities into this Netflix series. And so it feels improvisational. And though he takes a writing credit, he says that he asks a lot of the actors to, you know, to come up with the scenes, and they work things through that way. And there's a number of things that I really enjoyed about it. One, of course, is that it's set in Chicago. So it's not New York. It's not L.A. It's a different city. And Chicago has, it has its own flavor. And I remember visiting there 20 years ago. And so that was, it's just nice to get that something a little bit different. But the series is really focused on the lives of young people now, people in their 20s and 30s, trying to make sense of all the great social changes that we have, and in particular to their romantic dating sex lives. So you will have maybe in one episode a married couple, and that episode is entirely about decisions they'll make. For example, in one episode, they decide to have an open marriage, and this is what the wife wants and the husband doesn't want it. And they're sort of the center of the series, and their story crops up a few times over the length of it. And then you'll have maybe a friend you'll see in the first show will appear in the second, and the story will be about her. And so you end up, you know, the questions are being asked, who are we now? Like, what kind of choices are we making? How are we going to live? And it's a really interesting snapshot of life right now, particularly in America, where they're, you know, the culture wars are battling and they're trying to figure out who they are. And, you know, the open marriage thing gets really, really interesting.
Okay. But you were a child of the 80s when it comes to television, and we're going to go back to some of the things that formed you. And I want to play a clip from The A-Team, which was something that was very formative for you as a child. And this is where B.A. is unhappy about getting tricked to going to the airport because he didn't fly, did he?
Keep on going. We're going to turn right up here.
I ain't going to no airport, Hannibal. I ain't going to fly with that crazy fool, Murdoch.
Did I mention Murdoch?
Murdoch?
We're not going to the airport, B.A.
Isn't Murdoch kind of crazy?
If he's flying, then we are dying.
Turn right up there.
What you doing, sucker?
I think I'll get out for a minute.
What's going on here? This road leads directly to the airport, Hannibal.
This road is nowhere near the airport.
What's going on? Will somebody please tell me what's going on?
You lied to me.
Lied? Me?
I told you what I was going to do to you next time you try to take me on the airplane, didn't I?
Please, what is going on?
Now, B.A., you're going to have one of your anxiety blackouts. And now, take it easy, B.A. Take it easy.
Why'd he hit you?
Hit me? If he hit me, I'd be in the hospital.
It was sort of a real-life cartoon, wasn't it?
It was a cartoon. It was like some sort of the Victor Annual meets... the guy who made... The gadgets. What was he called? Because this is what they did.
MacGyver.
MacGyver. It was MacGyver meets the Victor Annual. It was a cartoon, but it was such a part, a staple of the Saturday
George
morning.
George Peppard as Hannibal, yeah. Mr. T as B.A. Baracus, and he became the big superstar out of it.
He did, yeah. And you know, I was thinking about how much we really loved shows like this and The Dukes of Hazzard and Knight Rider, and they, you know, there was something about television in the 1980s where it seemed that it framed every moment of our lives. And, you know, I can think of a particular time of the day now looking back in the house, and there'll be a TV show to sort of match that particular time of the day. And, you know, on the Saturday morning, it would be shows like that.
I believe you were a Countdown fanatic as a student.
Well, my mother was. I would come home from school every, and you know, on the Monday to Friday, and my mother would be watching Countdown and competing. You know, there would be Tomorrow's World in the evenings. You know, after, you know, in this, on the Saturday afternoons, you'd have Annika Rice, and then you'd have Blind Date, and then Noel Edmonds and Allo Allo and Bergerac and Poirot on a Sunday. And that's, you know, it seems
can
looking back at now.
Can you imagine yourself having that relationship with your own children as they grow up, that you'd be watching television on a Saturday evening like that?
We don't watch much television now. And, you know, and Netflix, of course, has changed that, because you just put on the show that you want to watch when you want to watch it. And also, of course, our laptops and YouTube. And so, you know, television has kind of been atomized in that way, and it no longer frames our lives.
Have you moved into podcasts?
I do. The interesting thing for me with podcasts was that I didn't actually get the podcast bug years ago, because I'm not the world's best listener. I prefer to read. And of course, you have children, and that changes. Reading becomes a luxury. So I spend a lot of time cooking meals, and driving around to the shops and minding kids. That's where the podcast comes in handy.
OK, your choice is Sam Harris Making Sense. What's this?
Sam Harris is a philosopher. He's a neuroscientist. He's a proponent of meditation. He's and now one of the world's most prominent podcasters. And this is a podcast that I find really, really stimulating, because he's somebody who has a deep and wide interest. And I suspect that, you know, if you were to take the people he has on the show now and look back from 50 years' time, you will see basically who matters now in the intellectual, scientific, psychological, cultural kind of world that we live in now.
And you've picked a clip with Ricky Gervais.
Traditionally, a comic is a court jester. They're down in the mud with the people making fun of the king. Carefully. You don't want to get off with his head. And so we have to be low status. Nowadays, people know what comedians like me earn.
Yeah. It's hard to be low status on a Gulfstream.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. So what do? I do it in two ways. One, I invite them in. I let them look behind the curtain. I go, what, you think it's brilliant being rich and famous all the time? Well, look at this. And, you know, I say, it's not all. Look how I embarrassed myself in front of the Queen. Or the first time I took a private jet, they thought I was the cook. So I let them in and go, I'm one of you. Right. I shouldn't be here, but I'm taking the piss, and it's not all roses. The other way I get low status is I talk about things where they're better off than me. Genuinely. I talk about being old and I'm going to die soon. I'm fat. I'm right. Going bald. I got, you know,
right.
I got distended testicles. So I do that. And then, you know, you can sort of get away with more. You know, that they get it. They get the joke. And I think that's preferable to lying. I think that's preferable to me going out there and pretending to be on welfare or pretending to still care about this or that. So I joke about being rich and I do it arrogantly so that hopefully they get the irony.
Ricky Gervais with Sam Harris.
Sam Harris has done a podcast on almost every meaningful topic there is to discuss at this point. I mean, anything you can imagine: politics, religion, immigration, abortion, the nature of consciousness, meditation. He's covered it all. And what's fascinating is his ability to go into considerable depth over sometimes hours. You know,
we're going to talk music for a little while. And the first single you ever bought is something that we ask our inductees. We don't always get to it. But in your case, it's such an unusual choice for a man of deep intellect like yourself.
Well, we have to start somewhere, Matt.
Tell us who it is.
Iron Maiden, The Evil That Men Do, 1988.
Slept in the dust with his daughter, eyes red.
Now, that's definitely the first time Iron Maiden have been on The Last Word. I don't know about Today FM.
I'm so thrilled that I got that on the airwaves. I really am.
It's usually a sign, though, of great intellect liking heavy metal music, you know.
You know, actually, there was a study done on this that people who liked heavy metal tended to be people who liked jazz and classical music later in age, you know, as I got older. And that's certainly been true for me. But let me set the scene. So I grew up in Donegal in the 1980s. I was in North Donegal, a place called Carndonagh, and a fine town it was, but there wasn't a lot going on culturally. I had an uncle, my sadly departed Uncle David, and every Christmas and birthday, a tape, a Maxwell C90 would arrive in the post with, you know, side A might be Metallica, Ride the Lightning, or, you know, side B might be Back in Black, AC/DC. And, you know, from about the age of 7, 8, these tapes started to arrive, and it was incredible because, you know, now I can look back and we know that heavy metal had become, you know, was actually a massive cultural moment. And, you know, it was something that was ignored by Rolling Stone and didn't take hip hop seriously either. But it sort of got on with its own thing. And I remember there was a moment when we were in the Sunday Tribune on the sub-editor's desk, and we did a head count of everyone on the desk. And it was like 8 out of 10 people had actually listened to heavy metal as teenagers. So Iron Maiden was something that was I grew up with, and you know, we laugh now at it, but the music is still fantastic.
You moved to Radiohead, and your favourite album, favourite band we asked you for, you've gone for Radiohead's In Rainbows. So here's House of Cards. Beautiful track from a beautiful, beautiful album. Why Radiohead?
There was a time in the 90s when we were all obsessed with Radiohead as a guitar band. And I think secretly a lot of us just wanted Radiohead to keep rewriting The Bends and OK Computer.
Which are magnificent albums.
Extraordinary albums. And, you know, but, you know, Tom York and Johnny Greenwood are very serious artists, and they had to grow. And we sort of went along with them. We, you know, we hummed and hawed. Kid A, of course, is a masterpiece. But we went along. But I found around that 2007, I got the album. It was pay what you like download. And I actually paid them a tenner for it. Nobody gave them any money, but I gave them a tenner. And I listened to it for a couple of months, and I just was no longer on the same page as them. And I don't know why that was. And I ended up spending the next 10 years just actually listening to a lot of jazz. That's where I went musically. But in the last, this year, I would come back to this album, and I'm haunted by it. And I realise now, well, I'm now on the same page as it again, but there's just something about it that's quite sublime. It's like they've took their accessibility and their abstraction and put them together for the perfect combination. And I thought maybe this is just me that I think this is, you know, it's not their greatest, because we could say that's OK Computer, but it's certainly possibly their number two. And the Guardian, was it last week, had their top 100 albums of the new century, and this is the highest rated Radiohead album at number 11, and it's in the Rolling Stone top 500.
So best gig
at the Drive-In Temple Bar Music Centre, December 2000, a raucous post punk hardcore kind of art school band. that just tore the stage apart in a way I've never seen before or since.
Okay, I don't have time to play anything because I want to talk books in the few minutes we've left, and I do want to give a mention to your own new novel as well. But give us your favourite novel, given that that is what you are, you're a novelist.
I think the novel that floored me the most in the last 10 years, and that's a good way to look at it, is it's a book called 2666 by Roberto Bolaño. And it's a 900-page doorstopper that I did not want to read. And you look at it and you go, there's no way I'm going to read this. And I was going for a break to Athens when my first book came out. And I stood at the door and I had 5 books in my bag for 5 days. And I stopped, turned around, took the 5 books out, went back to the bookshelf, took down this book and said, I'm going to read this book no matter what. This is the
You were committing to it.
I was committing to it. Took it, started reading it on the airplane, and I started to inhale it. And I remember very little now of Athens, but the book is consumed me. And Bolaño was a fascinating figure who died the year before the book came out at the age of 50, awaiting a liver transplant. And this was his magnum opus. This is a book that changed South American literature in much the same way that Gabriel Garcia Marquez changed literature. And 2 years ago, my mother asked me for a list of books to read. She said, look, I'm just kind of bored. I want something different. And I checked with her first of what classics she hadn't read and put some classics on that list. For example, she hadn't read Anna Karenina by Tolstoy, which is a book, another doorstopper. But once you start reading it, you won't be able to stop. And so she had read this list of many modern classics, many 19th century classics. And at the end of it, I said to her, what's the book that you liked the most? She said, it's Roberto Bolaño's 2666.
Okay, we have 2 minutes left, so tell us about your new novel, Beyond the Sea.
So this is my fourth novel, and it's a book that was initially inspired by the true story of two Mexican fishermen who got washed out into the Pacific Ocean on a storm. They were at the mercy of the tides and ended up going further and further out into the Pacific. And a year later, one of them had survived the incident, and he'd lived off turtles and kind of trying to fish with his hands and drinking rainwater. And the pair of them had been living in a freezer on the boat, a small open panga. When I read this, I was struck with the idea of this as a Paul Lynch novel, something completely different, not the bare facts of the story, because that's just going to be, that's kind of journalism. I could see this as like a psychodrama where the two men were like Schrodinger's cat, both alive and dead at the same time, because they are moving out into the ocean and they are beyond rescue, it might seem. And so they are faced and confronted by who they are, by their past, the things they haven't done, the things they should have done. And they both look at the situation in completely different ways and ways that you might not expect. Hector is a teenager and Bolivar is a man in his late 30s, and they both have radically different responses, and they hate each other and they love each other. And the book goes into some very dark, dark places, and then I think comes out into a very, very hopeful, hopefully a very beautiful place.
I'm looking forward to reading it. Beyond the Sea is the new book by Paul Lynch, who has been going through his selections for us tonight on the Culture Club here on The Last Word on Today FM. Paul, thank you very much for being with us this evening.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.